to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, found online at kpfa.org. I'm Sasha Lilly. Labor historian, worker, organizer, public intellectual, and folklorist. These labels barely managed to encapsulate Archie Green, who redefined the field of U.S. folklore while forging his own path as an independent socialist. Green died 2 years ago at the age of 91, but scholar Sean Burns had a chance to talk extensively with him in his last years, and he's written the definitive study of Green. It's titled Archie Green, The Making of a Working Class Hero, and it's published by the University of Illinois Press. I'm pleased to have Sean Burns in studio with me today. Sean, why is Green regarded as one of the most respected folklorists in the U.S.? What, in fact, did he do?
Well, his primary contribution and the reason that those who are familiar with him are most likely familiar with him are because he was the sort of founding father of the American Folklife Center. That's part of the Library of Congress. And his sort of almost mythical lobbying efforts for years in the 70s to create that Folklife Center, which came out of the passage of the American Folklife Preservation Act in 1976. It's really that accomplishment that more than anything put Archie on the map. And when he, in 2007, many years later, was acknowledged by the Library of Congress and given the Living Legends Award, that accomplishment was central.
But obviously, for you, his impact was much greater and beyond the obvious accolades that he received. What distinguishes his contribution to the understanding of folklore?
There's definitely an important intellectual contribution. And as I explore in the book, that contribution is inextricable from the life that he led. Part of the examination in this book was to link this unique life history with the, what I argue, are profound contributions to not just the field of folklore and specifically public folklore, but labor history, American studies, cultural studies, media studies, and such, you know, a kind of a broad range of disciplines that in some manner or another wrestle with the question of culture. So Archie's coining of the term labor lore, in its most basic sense, labor lore is about an examination of the cultural practices and traditions of workers. And Archie was attuned to the sort of vitality of those traditions and practices because he spent years within those communities. His sort of profoundly transformative experience of entering the Civilian Conservation Corps after graduating from UC Berkeley in 1939, he goes up into the Northern California, Siskiyou County, and works within that important New Deal organization, and then returns in 1941 to begin dry dock shipwright work here in San Francisco. And it was those daily interactions with, multiracial working class that attuned his kind of vision for issues that I think years later would prove kind of profoundly transformative for the academic field. In other words, it was his work life that raised questions that later he explored in a scholarly manner that changed these disciplines in important ways.
You use the term labor lore. What does that mean?
Well, it's kind of a neologism that he coined first in his letters to friends and other discographers of worker music. It simply means the folklore of workers, so labor lore sort of combines those terms and brings our attention to something that, I guess sadly in this culture, we don't think is really that important, which is the cultural expression of workers. I mean, there's a long tradition, especially, of course, in the West, of seeing the very field of culture and the very sort of practice of generating something that's culturally worthy as, other than the working class. You know, that is something, that's the long tradition of sort of high and low cultural differentiation. And so labor lore in its, in the set of questions and in the set of concerns that it has sort of shatters that dichotomy, which, you know, still sort of lives a like zombie life in culture today.
Well, let's talk about Archie Greene's formation, who he was. His father was a Ukrainian Jew who had fled from the Tsarist Empire after the upheaval of the 1905 revolution, and his father was a participant in that upheaval. What impact did his family's radical immigrant background have on Archie Greene?
It had everything to do with his values and his lifetime of work. And I'll say this as a preface. As a social movement scholar, I have great interest in the question of sort of how the radical imagination takes shape and how ideas of social change travel circuitously through this world of ours. And so as I learned his early life history, this was stunningly compelling and engaging for me to hear of his father, a young man with a hidden typewriter mimeograph machine really under his floorboards producing socialist broadsides in 1905 and fleeing in the night from Cossack repression, going through Helsinki to England, going from England to Winnipeg, Canada, where in 1917 Archie was born. His family shortly thereafter in 1923 moves to Boyle Heights, East Los Angeles, and the opening chapters explore how the profoundly multiracial, international, and indeed kind of concentrated radical culture of Boyle Heights shaped his early life. I use some of George Sanchez's great work on that community in Los Angeles to kind of illuminate exactly what Archie was surrounded by.
Yeah, and what was going on in Boyle Heights in the years of his childhood in the 1920s?
Well, it was a kind of magnet for new immigrants, and those could be sort of Maganistas fleeing, Mexican Revolutionary contexts, certainly.
Anarcho-syndicalists.
Yeah.
Mexico.
Yeah, there were tons of European immigrants. There were, as he, described to me, Japanese neighbors, Armenian grocers. He would go through the streets and hear corridos coming out of, Mexican immigrant homes. So the range of cultures that he experienced in the streets and as he told, also experienced in his very home, the Greens welcomed so many of their neighbors into their home, and Archie grew up in a context where dialogues around the table were reflecting on the major political events of the time, and as I say, it's that context of what Michael Denning describes as the age of the CIO and the set of concerns that really shape the political formation of the old left, a generation that comes of age in between the Great World Wars, grappling with the Great Depression, facing the rise of international fascism, Stalinism. So all of these larger world events play out in specific, you know, kind of day-to-day ways in the context of Archie's young life.
And one of the things that you write about in your study of Archie Green is the cauldron of the times that he grew up in, was formed in, which was a time of great political ferment and conflict within the left, a moment of real upsurge of the left, and yet lots of fracture as well. So I wonder if you could just bring us back to those times to describe the kinds of political ferment and fissures that were the lifeblood of those times.
Well, this would be a good time to just state in a general sense that for somebody of my age who was educated and politicized in the 80s and 90s, it was completely compelling and invigorating to meet at 88 years old an elder radical like Archie Green, somebody who, you know, till his last breath was so intellectually and politically engaged. And by virtue of his long life, as you say, provided a way for me to connect to an era that I hadn't previously had exposure to because of the generation that my teachers came from and my parents, and because I didn't happen to have grandparents that had those kinds of commitments or concerns. But when you sat down and you began talking with Archie Green about his life and about his political history, you know, he would share stories of hearing Eugene Debs speak as a youth or going door to door in the context of Upton Sinclair's epic campaign, or what it was like to hear sort of young communists in his middle school run through the halls calling for strikes. And then I trace how, as he enters into university, how the context of student politics in the 30s was instrumental in his formation. Here's somebody who initially, you know, attended meetings of the Young Socialist Party, the YPSLs, or the Young Communist League. He very much was testing out the waters in a period that he kind of referred to as sandbox politics. Ultimately, he, I think, finds greatest affinity after some sort of traumatic experiences that I talk about in the book with the Young Democrats. And in a way, it's the excitement around the birth of the CIO.
And let me jump in and ask you, the CIO, who are they?
Yeah, the Congress of Industrial Organizations. This was an attempt, you know, led by people like John Lewis to begin organizing whole new communities of workers that traditionally hadn't been organized within unions of the American Federation of Labor. And so this tremendous upsurge in the wake of the Great Depression to organize labor and to expand the kind of social power and rights of workers in many more kind of industrial and manual fields was thrilling for Archie. You know, witnessed this happening around him, and in the context of time at UCLA and UC Berkeley as an undergraduate, sought out courses that were exploring these issues, and ultimately, you know, made a decision that he wanted to be a worker. And I talk about, you know, how profound just that simple, that drive was for a college educated, you could say, you know, middle. It's interesting because on one hand, culturally, he's very middle class. I mean, in terms of economics, his working class Jewish family in Boyle Heights lived very, very simply. But nonetheless, as 2% of the young men that went into the CCC had college degrees, and of that 2%, even culturally for a young Jewish man to pursue that path was very unusual. But he felt at ease within those working communities and with that identity. When he begins to work on the ship docks, the dry docks of San Francisco in the early 40s, he's completely captivated by his mentors and skilled teachers, largely militant Scottish shipwrights. And it's their cultural practices sort of fused with their mastery of shipbuilding that I think, you know, as part of creating this foundation of recognizing the worker as a certain kind of intellectual, recognizing the worker as constantly involved in cultural production, whether it be through clothing or their songs or their union rituals or the tales they told and the jokes they told. In that climate, when I speak about the laboring of American culture, a phrase that I borrow from Michael Denning's important work on the cultural front, I'm referring to the sort of the basic upsurge of union growth in that time, but it's not strictly about numbers in expanding labor unions. It's very much about a profound cultural shift that I and other people, of course, argue profoundly reshaped the United States and American culture.
The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, found online at kpfa.org. I'm Sasha Lilly, and I'm joined in studio by Sean Burns, who is the author of Archie Green, The Making of a Working Class Hero, and we're discussing the labor historian and folklorist. So Archie Green, as you mentioned, was born in the pivotal year of 1917, and the Russian Revolution and the politics of the Russian Revolution really shaped the left in the United States. And in the 1930s, the Communist Party had seen a real upsurge in membership and was very influential. And at the same time in the 1930s, there was the emergence of fascism or its growth, and there was something called the Popular Front that emerged out of anti-fascist organizing of some kind, understood very much now as being a Communist Party-dominated affair. Can you tell us about what the Popular Front was, what its politics were?
In the most specific and fundamental sense, the Popular Front is a term that's used to describe a four-year period in Communist Party history from 1935 to 1939. And that period is seen as a kind of departure from what's known as the Third Period. Departure in the sense that during the Popular Front, the new motivations and focus of the party were to be on building coalitions with other liberals and left constituencies, the idea being that the rise of international fascism necessitated a new time of reaching out to people that previously, in some cases, were seen as enemies.
Right, because the Third Period was an ultra-sectarian policy of the Communist Party worldwide, and so this was kind of a 180-degree turn that the Communist Party made.
Yeah, indeed. And so part of why people write about that era in complimentary terms is because it did witness new kinds of coalitions, new kinds of relationships between radical artists, musicians, and party members. Part of why I wrote this book, in a way, was to intervene in discussions of this era. And as I say in the intro, taking a cue from people like David Roediger and Michael Denning, I believe that there is a need to tell more stories from this era of people that were profoundly shaped and motivated by the concerns of the era, but that actually weren't Communist Party members. And as I sort of trace in the book, Archie actually develops a real aversion to the culture and the specific politics of the Communist Party. And a lot of that comes out of what he would, you know, for many decades continue to emphasize, the kind of flip-flopping politics of that era, where the Popular Front, as we said, a time of coalition building and against the rise of international fascism, and then when the Hitler Stalin non-aggression pact is signed in 1939, that sort of changes everything, and they go through a period of anti-war organizing, and that sort of a dramatic shift in kind of the culture and message of the party. And then shortly thereafter, once again, once Hitler invades the Soviet Union, they switch again to drumming the war beat and calling for, U.S. coalition with the Soviet Union, etc. So for Archie, it's not just that inconsistency alarmed him. It's that was indicative of, for him, larger questions about the nature of the Communist Party. And as I say, in this country, we haven't heard much about left anti-communism. Of course, we've heard plenty about conservative and right forms of critiquing that tradition. Archie,
and by anti-communism, you mean Communist Party communism?
Yeah, I mean it as a kind of capital C. Archie felt that the party, and this is to put in basic terms, had a kind of instrumental relationship to working classes. Instrumental in the sense of, utilizing their energy and their fervor and their numbers toward political principles and political vision that, according to him, was really sort of top-down dictated by party members, by the Kremlin, etc. One of the challenges of this work for me, of course, was sort of weeding out these very strong critiques that Archie would make. From particular life history that shaped those and placing them within a larger context of what other historians observe and witness of this era. And as I argue extensively in the second part of the book, I believe that in some ways his own experience as a shipwright in the sort of wake of the seriously militant battles of Harry Bridges of the Longshoremen's Union and Harry Lumberg of the Sailors in the Bay Area here, that his experience of that struggle, created certain kinds of loyalties and perspectives that, distorted some issues, but very importantly illuminated others. So,
well, and that's a particularly interesting episode in his life, which you've already mentioned briefly, which is, as you say, he became a shipwright, a shipbuilder on the dry docks of San Francisco, a location which had been really shaped by the tremendous class struggle of the preceding years before Archie Green started working there, the 1934 general strike, and then a 99-day strike in 1936-37. So you have a kind of a site of struggle, which is one of the key places of class struggle in that era on the docks here on the West Coast and in San Francisco. And at the same time, a lot of the types of conflictual politics within the left played out in a very strong way there between those people loyal to Harry Bridges, who was affiliated with the Communist Party in some way, who led the International Longshore and Warehouse Union. And then there were other configurations of the left also there. So what were those forces, and where did he, Archie Green, fall within those battles within the left?
Well, let me answer that with a bit of an introduction that I think is kind of vital for our moment now, a moment where so many people find themselves engaging in social movement building, new political actors, we might say, in the context of spreading Occupy movements and international struggles for democracy. Part of what this moment in Archie's life illuminates is that when we enter sort of public political engagement and social movement activity, it's hard to see the events that shape the conditions in which we find ourselves. And yet it's so important to kind of investigate those prehistories, I use George Lipschitz's term, the long fetch. What are the kind of circumstances that shape a political moment, you know, like a wave that can't be seen as that wave builds up? And for Archie Green, for me to understand the impact of the early 40s on the docks of San Francisco for him meant, as you suggest, tracing sort of the legacy of the 1934 militant struggles, the legacy of the 34 men, as they're referred to. I discovered that Archie was deeply impacted by a Scottish shipwright named Benny Carwardine. Like so many Scottish shipwrights that were in the Bay Area then, Benny came over here because the work on the Clyde Banks after World War I died off, and he immigrated here and found himself a very valued and necessary craftsman in the build-up to World War II. And Benny was shaped by a particular politics that this man, John McLean, a popular Marxist educator in Scotland, this is somebody that I never had heard of, but that proved very important in terms of making sense of Archie's kind of unusual melding of ethnic nationalism, a kind of concern for the importance of culture to politics, but also sort of anarcho-syndicalist shop floor militancy. Benny Carwardine was very early on kind of anti-Bridges, and he expressed that for Archie Green. He was not a fan of the Communist Party, and this was in the context where, you know, union loyalties were shifting and the AFL and the CIO were vying for different industries. So it was a very intense time, and what I say in general is that to understand why people had certain loyalties means that we must look in really situated ways at the context that they find themselves in and who, you know, they are influenced by.
And that question of sort of context and history is so interesting because, of course, these Scottish dock workers had their own radical histories on the docks, which then gets imported to the West Coast here. But one of the threads that seems to run throughout with Archie Green, and we hear less of this in the histories of that era, which do tend to focus on the Communist Party, is that kind of syndicalist thread, that earlier legacy of the IWW, the Wobblies, those syndicalists from abroad, Daniel De Leon and his Socialist Labor Party, and then I guess there's sort of the Trotskyist element in all of this, but this is all movements or organizations of the left that define themselves as different and often opposed to the prevailing Communist Party of the time. And this seems to be very much something that Archie Green was part of, absorbed, and influenced his ideas into the future. And one of the things that you write about in Archie Green, The Making of a Working Class Hero, is the way that the dominance during that period of the Communist Party had a great cultural impact, not just simply the way people organized, the forms they organized, the kind of politics that they championed in that kind of narrow political sense, but it also had a great cultural impact during a time where the culture of the left, also through the New Deal, was being in many ways nurtured, expanded, and so on. How did the Communist Party influence culture, broadly speaking, since that's obviously very important for Archie Green?
The topic of the Communist Party's influence on American culture is most commonly approached through the impact that the party had on a kind of folk revival that coincides with their own emergence as a party and you know, has the face of well-known names like the Almanac Singers that included people like Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger. So the music of the day shifted to kind of express this new ethos of sort of respect for working class life and a sense of dignity for that kind of pursuit. And so when we talk about the laboring of American culture in this era, we're talking about a sort of general and more diffuse shift in recognizing the value of laborers. And I tell stories about that, how that was expressed in particular theater, like The Cradle Will Rock of 1937. And I think that, you know, that, let me use that as an example to tell a particular story. That play, musical, is often seen as a kind of hallmark moment of a artistic creation that exemplifies interest and reveals concern for working class issues. And I write in the book how contemporary composer Aaron Copland says that finally this Cradle Will Rock is expressive of sort of the feelings and vernacular culture in the streets. And I specifically want to refer to that because this is something that Archie Green very much took issue for. Because Archie felt that the particular kind of folk music that we associate with the Communist Party and most popularly with these revivals, both the one in the late 30s and the one that we're more familiar with in the late 50s and early 60s, those are associated with a kind of popular folk music sound and politics in a way. And when Archie thought about the Cradle Will Rock, he thought about the fact that this play set in a kind of metaphorical steel town of USA, it did not utilize the sort of Eastern European polka, accordion-driven music that no doubt would have been played in those homes and you know, ethnic halls and union halls of the day. Instead, it kind of reflected a more kind of avant-garde proletarian opera sensibility that reflected what those communist composers and playwrights of the day were trying to express through their work. For Archie, this begins a lifelong kind of effort to distinguish what he understood as vernacular culture from what is often talked about as, you know, folk music in a more popular sense, or we might say the difference between folk interpreters and those who, you know, in Archie's perspective, really emerge out of sort of rooted communities and produce what he would call vernacular culture. And one of the really interesting and challenging parts about writing his story was this. I mean, I meet him late in his life, and he expresses to me strong opinions about the negative impact of the music of people like Pete Seeger, of Bob Dylan, of Joan Baez, of all these people that I have enjoyed and revered in many ways for years, and whose politics I support, and in also see that Archie would in so many ways. So how could he be so critical? To make sense of his opinions about folk music meant for me to make sense of his experience within the Popular Front. So that's a key effort in the book, is to draw those together. When Archie would say about the music of Pete Seeger that, ultimately the ideology of its politics would be so much less impactful and formative in our world than the style, that, you know, required me to really reflect on what he was saying about aesthetics and their impact on pluralism. For Archie, the continued emphasis on celebrating, preserving, and discovering vernacular, you know, what he would describe as authentic cultural expressions, it was of utmost importance. And this was additionally difficult because here's a man who intellectually I knew, because of his longtime work in folklore, he understood how problematic it would be to claim any particular culture as authentic per se.
Indeed.
You know, he understood that any particular song tradition or dance tradition or labor tradition could be investigated historically and be found to exist as a kind of result of many tributaries of historical influence. So what, you know, is authenticity? Well, Archie marked particular cultural expressions as authentic, I came to understand and claim. He marked them as such because of their importance for a larger political project that he felt himself engaged in, and he felt vital to the health of American democracy. So for him, supporting marginalized expressive traditions was about maintaining a kind of plurality that he felt was threatened by, cultural and political homogeneity. It's important to keep in mind that this interest of his goes way back to coming to political life in a time where fascism and Stalinism were, you know, sort of dominant threats to, according to Archie, cultural pluralism. I mean, he describes in the most basic sense fascism and Stalinism as monism, you know, as cultural and political monism. And his efforts, if we were to, in the most broadest strokes, characterize his lifetime efforts, it was to fight tirelessly for cultural pluralism. And in his mind, its essential place in a democracy, its essential place in an egalitarian and just world.
That is the voice of Sean Burns. He is the author of Archie Green, The Making of a Working Class Hero, published by University of Illinois Press. He's a scholar of social movements and a musician in his own right. So how should we understand this notion of cultural pluralism as it relates to a radical political agenda? What's the connection between the more overt politics and the more perhaps subterranean or perhaps not culture for Archie Green?
Well, in a way, for me, entering grad school in 2002 and finding a community in the humanities that were importantly concerned with the place of difference in our understandings of culture and cultural production, I saw Archie's emphasis on cultural pluralism as making a lot of sense and as kind of paving the way, importantly, for those social movement and scholarly concerns of the time. The emphasis on cultural pluralism, you know, is, which for Archie has roots in his love for anarcho-syndicalism and a kind of political sensibility that is really best expressed in the multiracial, multi-ethnic, international culture of the Wobblies. That, for him, meant that he envisioned a social and political life that was highly decentralized. He was very concerned about concentrations of power in all their forms, be it culturally, socially, religious, politically. So part of the difficulty and contradiction of analyzing his life is that here's a man who's so attuned to seeing with a skeptical eye those concentrations of power, yet he was also deeply inspired and moved by New Deal politics, by an era that had great fervor for large-scale organizations, a great fervor and respect for the role that the government could play in forwarding cultural pluralism and democracy. It's important to remember that mentors like Benjamin Botkin of Archie's that, you know, established through the WPA programs to document in the 30s and 40s the great plurality of American culture sort of, you know, paved the way for Archie's creation of the American Folklife Center. And that, you know, what that means for us today and what it meant for Archie in terms of his continued work in his life to create institutions that fostered people's attention for cultural pluralism. It means that, you know, we build movements that are expressive of the full range of cultures of its constituents. If Archie was here with us today, and he no doubt would be very excited about the spread of Occupy movements over the country, a movement that at its core is about people telling their stories, about people expressing their particular position within a political and economic system, a position and story that has been silenced by dominant narratives, and working out in general assemblies across this country a way of communicating with one another and organizing and envisioning with one another while motivated and inspired by that plurality. So when people, you know, attend these general assemblies and come away with a sense of profound, you know, both excitement for the range of voices that are heard, that is the important and difficult, no doubt, work of creating truly democratic spaces. And that's what Archie was interested in doing.
He had a very long life and a very kind of remarkably productive life. After his years on the docks, he, you know, so kind of compressing many decades here, he went back to school, became a scholar of labor and of folklore. And as you mentioned earlier, he had this very big impact on the preservation of folklore in the U.S. through lobbying for many years, just full-time lobbying Congress to support this American Folklife Center, which did eventually come to pass. And that has had its impact on the way that folklore and labor are memorialized, preserved, and so on. And then in his latter years, he was incredibly prolific. It's a very tall order, but we are running out of time. So I wonder if you could talk just briefly about his writings and the impact of those books that he wrote.
Archie was tremendously prolific in his, quote, retirement years. And one of the things I say is that that kind of unusual reality can obscure our ability to see his work and his concerns as a part of the age of the CIO. This is a man who was a contemporary of E.P. Thompson. He was actually older than him. He was older than Althusser, of Raymond Williams. He was a contemporary of C. Wright Mills, of Herb Gutmann's. And yet, because he wrote so much of his work in his 70s and 80s, we can fail to notice that continuity of concerns. And so that's part of the work of the book, is to place them in that context. The essence of Archie's books that explore labor lore in a wide range of its forms of expression, from his first book in 1972, Only a Miner, that is a kind of hallmark study of coal mining songs, to his later books on the kind of material culture tradition of creating tin men, of sheet iron workers, to his collaboration with Utah Phillips and Bill Friedland and Dave Roediger and Rosemont, Franklin Rosemont, in the Big Red Songbook. I mean, all of these books in their variety of ways are trying to document workers' culture. And in order to do that, Archie found himself having to investigate economics and labor history. He found himself having to investigate the history of the record industry in terms of and those technologies and how that impacted cultural production and sort of mobility of these cultural forms. I mean, in short, what I found is in this man's work a kind of foundational contribution to what I think of as American cultural studies. I argue that I think he's one of the great intellectuals of the 20th century, that I think he should be understood as central to the historiography of what we call new labor history. He should be central to what we think of today as contemporary media studies and contemporary cultural studies. And in order to understand how I could make that claim, I invite and encourage people to check out the myriad books that he wrote, the hundreds of articles that he wrote. The conclusion of the book is a really amazing interview that folklorist Nick Spitzer did with Archie days before he passed in San Francisco in 2009. And in that interview, you get a sense of Archie's, fervor for these lifetime concerns, and you get a sense of him being in dialogue with one of his students, Nick, who has gone on to be an important radio producer of American Roots, and a program that's indicative of the kind of vernacular culture that Archie celebrated, and the links of understanding that vernacular culture into the against the larger social, political, milieu that we must attend to understand their origins and their impact.
Sean, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Sasha. It's been an honor to be on a program that I think has made tremendous contributions to contemporary movement building and the work that you and CS, producers like Eddie Yuen, have done are invaluable and have my fullest respect.
Thank you for that. My guest has been Sean Burns, scholar of social movements and of Archie Green. He has written The Definitive Study of Archie Green, Archie Green, The Making of a Working Class Hero, just published by the University of Illinois Press. And he is, among other things, a musician. His band is Professor Burns and the Lilac Field. We have a link to the book and his band on our website, againstthegrain.org. Against the Grain is co-produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please check us out on the web at againstthegrain.org, where you can find on-demand and downloadable audio, and it's the most reliable way to sign up for our podcast. You can also call us at 510-848-6767, extension 670, or visit us on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio. I'd like to thank our engineer today, Jill Montgomery.